This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
Hello and welcome to Newsmakers. I'm your host, Lisa Pugh. The end of federal pandemic relief dollars, record inflation, a staffing shortage, and increasing mental health needs are creating a perfect storm in school districts across Wisconsin. The final deal on the next 2 years of education funding might be the final decision of the Joint Finance Committee that's deliberating the biennial budget as we speak. Joining us to talk about education funding in the budget, as well as making their predictions, are Alan Borsak, a senior fellow at Marquette Law School, Aaron Richards, editorial director at the Center for Reinventing Public Education, and Kaleem Kerr, CEO and founder of One City Schools here in Madison. So welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Let's just dive right in. Alan, we won't say the year, but you've been covering education issues in Wisconsin for a while.
Dinosaurs roamed the earth, yes.
How would you describe the current fiscal situation for Wisconsin schools? Is it different?
It's easy to overstate that because it was never a case that, show me a school leader who says I've got too much money. That I've never met one. It's gotten tighter. It's really tight. It's tight in the public sector. It's tight in the charter schools. It's tight in the private schools. There's no question that everyone's feeling squeezed.
Aaron, you've been a longtime education reporter. Now you kind of have this national perspective. Is what's Wisconsin experiencing similar to other states?
Yes, from what we've seen and some of the work we've done with other groups that are tracking education funding more specifically, you know, what's going to happen to all districts here is because of the pandemic relief money running out in 2024, some districts have been able to do some sleight of hand for now because they can fill some holes, they can move some stuff around, but the fiscal cliff that's coming has been sort of talked about a lot, and we're not there yet, but we know the needs are really high with pandemic recovery efforts, and then also, like, if you don't have a way to continue that extra funding for therapists or tutoring, what happens to those, you know, what happens to that once the money is gone? So that's what we're starting to see, and nobody has a real good solution for it yet, but Wisconsin's not really out of step that far. I mean, all the states are dealing with the same thing.
Kaleem, you run two public charter schools. I know you testified before the Joint Finance Committee. You talked specifically about the needs of Black youth. Mm-hmm. How would an increase in funding improve things for Black youth in Wisconsin?
Well, first of all, you know, we have seen a drop off dramatically in student performance. The problem was really bad before the pandemic. For in Madison, where we are located, only 12% of Black students were reading at grade level in third grade prior to the pandemic. Now it's down to 7%. And there's not a lot of resources to actually address that directly. And so for us, the fact that the $9,264 per pupil that all independent public charter schools get in the state per pupil, it hasn't changed much in the last 3 years, but our costs have gone up significantly. We deal with inflation just like everyone else, but then the educational needs of the students, the social support needs of the students have increased dramatically. And what we're doing basically in charter schools is reaching out to people in the private sector to financially help us. And for us, that this year, that's to the tune of $3.7 million we have to raise privately just to keep our schools open.
To meet additional needs.
Yes.
School administrators testifying before the Joint Finance Committee shared a lot about decisions that they say they're being forced to make, maybe that they didn't have to make in the past in the public school system. Cutting educators, eliminating programming, delaying basic operational funding needs. They say it's a direct result of lack of inflationary increases. Do you think that that's an appropriate correlation to make?
Oh, certainly. It's more than just simply the inflation, though. It's, as Kaleem was saying, the needs of kids are different now than they were 5 years ago or 25 years ago. The pressures to improve are greater. The difficulty of dealing with the culture that we're in is greater. Just the demands are greater. The demands on schools, on teachers are very high. And that translates into costs. And it's not just Milwaukee or Madison. The people who are testifying were statewide. I mean, some of the the most lucrative or the most financially strong school districts in Wisconsin or communities in Wisconsin. I've talked to administrators there who sound like they're talking about, you know, the city of Milwaukee, but they're talking about their own communities.
Is that something surprising to you, Aaron, that it's affecting both wealthy and lower income districts?
I don't. It's not surprising. I think we're just, as Alan has said, I think we're at a point where the needs of kids are so high, and serving those needs is expensive. If you want to have really good teachers in front of kids that have fallen the farthest behind, if you're going to target your resources effectively, how are you going to incentivize a really good teacher to teach kids for either more hours or longer, you know, a longer school year or day? You need to offer incentives. If you want, you know, to get the best and the brightest, then you need to pay for it. Sometimes I think that there's just some reluctance in the public to understand just how the forces of the pandemic have brought to the forefront an enormous amount of needs that were already there, but they're just expensive to serve. If you're going to hire more therapists and keep them into the future after the pandemic relief funding runs out, we have to be willing as a society to pay for that. And I just don't know if that's happening yet. I don't know if the broader public has fully realized the cost of doing business in the place that we're at right now.
Kaleem, is funding the magic answer? You know, earlier this school year, you had to close mm-hmm. your 9th and 10th grades. Do you blame lack of funding? Is that the main reason?
No, it wasn't lack of funding. It was lack of readiness for our students. Our students weren't ready for the early college and career program that we kicked off this year as a part of 9th and 10th grade. 85% of our 9th and 10th graders were behind two or more years. 67% were behind 5 or more years academically. The majority of our 9th and 10th graders actually were at a second, third grade level in math and language arts. So our teachers just weren't prepared to teach that population as many kids as we had, and so we started losing teachers. And our job wasn't, we're not in the business of providing a substandard education for children. So we talked to families, talked to staff, and we decided to move on. But the budget itself, given the magnitude of the challenge that we saw come into our classrooms with students so far behind, to move those students forward, you need teachers that are really ready for that. You do have to incentivize them, but you also have to provide other types of support for them. For example, our students were in what we call prep year. Those students had a teacher and a reading specialist working with them, and we needed a teacher and a math specialist to work with them too. We had a teacher, me, because we lost teachers. I had to go in and start helping to teach math classes. But we met the students where they were and then worked to move them forward academically from there. Takes a lot of effort, takes resources, and it takes really special educators to work with students that are that far behind. So having the resources needed to do that is something that the state really needs to consider.
School districts talk about the revenue limits, lack of increases in revenue limits. 6 of the last 8 school years, no revenue limit increase. The last 2 years, none at all. Is there a price to pay for that decision now? Is that, you know, how do you think legislators look at the revenue limits?
Well, you would hear among many legislators, on the Republican side particularly, that money isn't the answer, that schools have a lot of money, that they have about as much money as the national average is, maybe a little over that even, and that whenever we increase money, we don't seem to see better success. There's some legitimacy to this of saying, you know, we've spent lots of money and things haven't gotten better. On the other hand, show me a way to cut spending to higher results, and I'd be really impressed by hearing that, because it just isn't so. Class sizes go up. There is some element of saying the more we pay teachers, the more we can look for good teachers, quality and so on, and the less we pay, the more we're looking for perhaps not the best. So does
the best... Would you expect a big increase in revenue limits this time around?
Do you think? I don't, only because they're so divided and they're so gridlocked that I think everyone agrees there has to be an increase, unlike 2 years ago in the budget, but I don't expect it'll be what anyone in the education spectrum is looking for.
Aaron, what about the rural-urban differences in Wisconsin? I think it's enrollment data shows more than half of all students in Wisconsin attend districts with fewer than 1,000 students. How does that pan out for kids?
I mean, Wisconsin has always been a little bit unusual in comparison to some other states where there's more bigger districts spread out across the state. So, you know, we kind of, when you're looking at all the budgets for districts everywhere, there's this behemoth called Milwaukee, and then there's a secondary one for Madison, and then everyone else, it goes down, you know, pretty quickly once you get through Wisconsin's more major cities. That has tended to mean that in some rural areas, there's just trying to spread resources out for a district when there's a very small number of kids, it tends to get harder over time if you're doing it with limited resources. When I was at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, there were some consolidations of districts, but that, I mean, that takes a lot of time. I don't think we've seen any wholesale mergers recently to try to account for that. But there are definite struggles out in rural areas because they just don't have as many options. They're often fighting even harder for teachers, many of whom want to be more in an urban area. So I think there's some additional challenges there. But again, I think these are fairly similar across the country. We're seeing the same, you know, sort of priorities shifting based on whether you're, you know, in a more metro area or whether you're out in the country.
Kaleem, you mentioned the funding gap between public charters and public schools. You mentioned how far kids are behind. How much of a funding increase would actually catch kids up? Can kids who are so far behind, can they catch up?
You can. You just need more time. You need additional people to help with that because you really need to concentrate your focus on kids who are behind. A teacher, you know, reading specialist that could work with 4 to 6 kids at a time around a kidney-shaped table and working with them. I mean, so there's ways to address that, but you have to have the resources. For us, we look at our neighbor to the south, Illinois, and their state law, it says that their public charter schools get no less than 97%, no more than 103% of what district-run the public schools get. In Wisconsin, we're 38% less as independent charter schools. So the average school across the state spending gets almost $12,000 per kid. We get $9,264. Then you add local funding, which public charter schools that are independent do not qualify for. That goes up to about $15,000 per kid. So there's this huge gap, but then we serve the neediest students generally. And so I have the neediest students in Dane County. I have my population is majority African American, 62%. You add the fact that most of my kids have a black parent that are biracial, that goes up to 80. Our poverty rates are higher, our special education rates are higher. But I just get that amount per kid regardless of their grade level, and then I have to go out and raise the rest. So our cost this year were about $22,000 commensurate with Madison. They get that money from the local community, the federal government, the state. We get state money and a little bit of federal aid.
You're confident if you had
so I have
that
to raise $10,000 per kid.
That you could help to increase
it
the
would
outcomes.
Decrease the pressure we have on donors. We're asking just last we had our board retreat this weekend. And they were saying, donors are saying, you know, this is a public responsibility to educate kids in the public schools. How long can we be asked to spend $10,000 per kid on your students when the state should be picking up that cost? And so we're hopeful that they'll help cover some of that gap. So right now we're looking at to get between that $12,000 to $15,000. And that's what we've been talking to the legislature with that. Number one, we can stay in business. Without that $12,000, you're going to see a lot of independent public charter schools close.
Is this, Aaron, is the situation with Wisconsin charter schools unique, or what looks different in our state?
Well, I'd actually like to go back to your question before about how much would it cost to get kids back on track? There's actually been a lot of discussion nationwide. In the beginning of our COVID recovery efforts, there was a big focus on, you know, what they call high dosage tutoring, meaning that you're giving kids consistent during the school day tutoring on specific subjects to catch them up. Now that takes more money because you need to have people that are someone besides the classroom teacher be a high quality tutor. What we're starting to see is that it may not just be a matter of money that gets kids caught up. There might need to be a bigger, broader policy push to rethink some of the ways that we accelerate kids through school. What we're hearing from some folks is that there's such a wide disparity from where kids are in a class. If you've got someone working 4 grade levels behind and 5 grade levels ahead, that it doesn't matter how much tutoring you do, or you could even add 5 more years to the actual span, you know, from K-12, add 5 more years on and we're still not going to catch kids up. There's just some research that came out of that from Stanford. And so there is more talk that's starting to brew about what policy changes could we make to free schools from some of the rigid ways that we advance kids through school to recognize that we could accelerate some kids in some subjects. You might be working ahead of your grade level in one subject and you know, you need more help in another. So I do think that this is not just a question of how much money do we have, but how much flexibility and freedom do schools have to make these changes that maybe get away from some of the one teacher, one classroom model as well.
You talked about the partisan nature of things. Do you think there's the climate to actually bring about fundamental change in education?
To be honest, no. I don't think people are willing to work together to say what's best for kids. And this is really a deep concern. You're hearing more impassioned and strong calls from the public sector, from the public schools for what they need. You're also hearing more impassioned and even, maybe panicky is too strong a word, calls from the charter schools and the virtual school and the voucher schools for more money, because they're so much against the wall. You're seeing schools starting to close. Hope High School closed in Milwaukee a year ago. Penfield Montessori Charter School is closing in Milwaukee. At least they're trying to save it now, but they're saying we are about to go out of business, and we cannot do what needs to be done with the amount of money we're getting. So are people willing to listen to this and actually say, what do kids need? I'm afraid I'm not so optimistic on that.
There's also a matter of declining enrollment, too, which many
districts... And that's how schools are funded.
Exactly, right? So when you have a lot fewer students, over time, that means that you get less money. And so how do you maintain programming? On one hand, you could say, well, you have fewer students, you don't need as much money. But there are certain ongoing costs that school districts have. So we've already got a declining birth rate. We have kids that have shifted around a lot in the pandemic. We've got hundreds of thousands of kids that we don't even know where they went. They're going to show up in the data later at some point. But how do we... There is such urgency here, and there's so much political infighting that we can't seem to... There are other states that are doing a better job of broadcasting a message that this is an urgent time and we need urgent attention on some pretty big issues. But I'm not seeing that here.
Urgency, politically. Yeah. Clem, there's been a lot of debate over the years in Wisconsin about our parallel school systems, public system, charter school system, voucher system. Why do you think it's important to maintain those parallel systems? Because some people would say, in this funding situation with the dire needs of kids, we can't have all of these options to fund with state tax dollars.
You know, families want options for their children. That's number one. They're going to seek those no matter what. And that's important. But, you know, charter schools, for example, were meant to serve two purposes. One was to build a sense of innovation in traditional public education, be models of what that could become, with the hope that what we would do, traditional public schools would start to model after not just the educational programs, but actually how we operate to develop more economies of scale and efficiencies financially, too. But then second was those students who are in areas where there are not high-quality schools or there are not programs for them that could prepare them for future occupations, that you can create schools in those environments to serve those students. That need hasn't changed. It's still here.
So we need more charter?
You need more. And here's my belief is I believe traditional public education should operate more charter-like. It should be more flexible. It should be more available to students, resources put into those areas where students need it the most. The Education Law Center in Rutgers University did a report in 2017, said that to just get students to basic levels of proficiency who are largely behind in poverty, you need to spend $20,000 to $30,000 per kid. Above that, if you want to get them to proficiency, it's about $5,000 when they looked at what schools were doing to try to address this issue. We're not asking for that much money. It'd be nice to have that. But it just shows you that, yes, there are only so many dollars to go around. We need these options. But at some point, we have to start looking at, you know, how do we build efficiencies within schools? And what I would love to see is I would love to see more charters serve as laboratories of innovation and be funded that way, so that we could now start to intentionally learn from them to see how we could remodel education in America, because I don't think there's anyone that could defend this and say, if you look broadly across our spectrum of public schools, that public education in America needs a reboot.
Alan, we have a Democratic governor, former state superintendent. We have a Republican legislature advocating for universal statewide school choice. Where is the middle ground on this issue? What do you think those backroom conversations are looking like?
I'm not sure there are any. I mean, if you're looking for optimism on that, I'm not your guy. I'm afraid I'm not. An important factor, if you look at Milwaukee, is that only slightly over half of the kids in the city of Milwaukee who are getting publicly funded education are getting it through the traditional Milwaukee public schools, what you think of when you think of MPS. They're getting it through vouchers, quarter of all the kids in the city. About 15 to 16% are getting it through charters. 5,000 to 6,000 kids are getting it in suburban public schools through the state's open enrollment. People are choosing to go elsewhere. So if you say, should we have two systems? I don't know how to answer that except that we do, and we ought to figure out how to make it the best for all as many kids as possible. It's very conceivable that within the next 2 or 3 years, MPS will actually fall below the 50% mark of educating kids in the city of Milwaukee because people are choosing to go elsewhere.
A lot of the solutions that we've all been talking about involve increased staffing. I know you looked at the pandemic impact on students in your organization. Lots of mental health needs for kids requires more people, but there's a shortage. Are there policy changes that you've seen other states make in terms of educators and staffing that could be helpful?
Yes, there's been a growing movement, and this would not solve the issue, but there's been certainly a growing movement of grow your own programs where more districts are trying to harness students' interest in education in high school and give them a very specific path to get credentialed, to in some cases have their tuition waived or cut significantly with a promise that they'll come back and teach in that district once they get through. Now, that's a long-term solution, right? You've got at least 4 years of education in there. There's also been more movement around helping folks who are already working in schools as support staff, as aides, to give them very clear and efficient tracks to get additional training to become teachers in the places where they're already developing close connections with kids. I mean, we know that that really plays a role in your school culture, is having peers around you who share your culture and your beliefs and really believe in you. And so I think the more that we can make those paths attainable for folks who are already in schools and demonstrating interest, we've certainly seen that. We've seen certainly in some cases policy changes that relax licensure requirements to get more people from the field when you're teaching specialty subjects in high school to think about a career switch and coming to education instead. There's a lot of levers we can pull here, and honestly, some of them don't have to be politically fraught. I mean, some of these are not, you know, a right and a left issue. It's just good policy to talk about what changes we could make here to increase the staffing pipeline. There's also movements to allow teachers to work in teams more, so there's a more of a collaborative career ladder, so people stay invested in education and don't, you know, leave it.
Last week, the Joint Finance Committee removed many policy initiatives that the governor had put in the budget, including more than $270 million in mental health supports. Do you anticipate, would you like to see that money put back in? What kind of mental health support or staffing would be helpful in your school?
We could certainly use more guidance counselors, school psychologists, school social workers. There are not enough. Those of us who are out here trying to hire those individuals are, you know, casting our line in a very depleted pool of people who have those certifications and specialties. So you can put the money in, but where are the people? And so our view is you have to answer both of those questions. And right now, those individuals pretty much go through a traditional school of education. There are more alternative pathways for teachers, but not necessarily for social workers and those other specialist trades. So that has to be developed to be funded. So my view is it's great to have that in there, but you're putting money in a system that needs more people to be funded. So I think a remodeling of what the governor put out there would be important. So you focus on first cultivating and developing these new mental health workers that are going to specifically work with young people and fund that at the same time.
Joint Finance Committee co-chair Howard Markline said during hearings that education is the committee's number one priority. And I think the governor would agree with that. They seem to all want to fund education at a really high level. Do you have any thoughts on where that comes out? You know, governor's 17% increase, will we see more than prior years?
I think we'll see more than prior years because prior years were so flat, and everyone agrees that inflation and other factors are important. So it's still going to be fairly incremental because that's about as far as they can go and agree on things. There might be some exceptions. There seems to be some possibilities for bipartisan work on reading as an issue and trying to reform Wisconsin's approach to reading, because our reading scores statewide are not good, and especially among low-income and black and brown kids. But it's actually statewide. So there's some possibilities. There will be a state budget, but the only answer, and it's the same way as 2 years and 4 years ago, is largely through incremental, because no one's willing to do bold stuff.
There have been some agreement on other issues so far in the budget, or at least it appears that way, around, for instance, shared revenue. That was kind of the headline over the weekend. Aaron, are you hopeful for Wisconsin in terms of the ability to shift how policy supports the improvements in schools?
Oh, this is a complicated question. I think one issue is that I just don't see Wisconsin doing the big, bold change that's necessary, especially at this time coming out of the pandemic. Money is one thing, but talking about how do we better inform parents about where their kids are at? How do we work as communities to support our schools? How do we get businesses more invested in coming into the schools and working? There's a lot more creative solutions that are being discussed across the country, and I'm not always optimistic when I look at my own landscape statewide. There are really good schools in Wisconsin and Milwaukee and Madison, but those really good schools are often the places that many kids aren't going to be able to access. So I wish that there was more broad stroke conversations about doing things creative and differently and supporting the neediest kids. I'm seeing that more in other states than I'm seeing here.
What are your conversations like with policymakers? Do you think they're hearing what's happening in the charter schools?
Yeah, I'm going to meet with them again right after this to actually go over our budgets so that members of the Finance Committee can actually see what it looks like when you're funding a charter and if you put additional revenue in, where it would go and how we could impact students. Both are listening. Both Democrats and Republicans that we've met with have said they support closing the gap with charters. They haven't said how much. And, you know, we're hopeful that it's significant. We've been a case for why we need at least $12,000 per kid to keep our doors open. Yeah, Alan's mentioned that we've already seen schools close. We'll see more of those. But the bigger challenge that I see is that the public, I hold them just as accountable for this as I do legislators. We have only 8% of black students in third grade reading at grade level in this state. That's our standard for literacy today. Standard for literacy coming out of slavery has always been a standard by which you're valued and you're able to own property and buy land and move forward educationally. 10% of former slaves were literate, or to be a black people were literate when slavery ended in 1865. So if you just look at the way we measure it then, even now, it's different, but there was a standard. We're worse than it was when we came out of slavery. There's not a lot of movement in the community around that, so we're very quiet. And I'm looking at my own colleagues in the black community. I'm like, why are we allowing this to happen? Why are we not down at the Capitol? Why are we not in our community telling parents? The other thing is attendance. Attendance has dropped off at schools dramatically. Our attendance rate went from 96 to 83 during the pandemic, and it's hovered at about 88. Since then, we're probably better than most schools that serve our student population. Can't educate a student that's not in class. So one of the things I do like about what the Republicans have put, for example, in the reading initiative, I'm not sure how much that has had Democratic hands involved in it, but if students, as the proposal says right now, they're in that lowest band in third grade, they repeat a grade. And I think, if anything, it's not necessarily a magic bullet to have a kid repeat a grade, but there has to be something that gets parents' attention as to why it's really important for your child to be in class every day, to be at school on time.
And the consequences.
Time on task matters, and what are the consequences, yes, of them not being present. So there has to be more than just the legislature addressing this. It has to be community more engaged in this, too.
We're rounding out our time, and I'm going to ask you each one question. What needs to happen for things to get better for students in Wisconsin?
As I said earlier, I think if everybody, both parties, across the state, just focused on what's working, what would work, what needs to be done, with the eye on kids, and not on partisan advantage and partisan posturing, we'd be better off. So, to calm down the atmosphere and really look at what works and what needs to happen. So it's pretty idealistic, but that's where I'm at.
Aaron?
We need clearer directives from both the state and educators about the depth of loss among many students. We need better measurements that show this is the gap that we need to close, and we need to better communicate those to the community. There's ways for everyone to get involved here to support the recovery of kids. And I think that that is something that is also missing from the conversation because of so much political infighting. We need a strong plan for recovery, and we need to look for those schools that are actually able to do the work so we can try to replicate and expand those ideas and those practices.
Kaleem, if you could point to one thing.
I'd love to see the governor, the leader of the Senate and Assembly, and bring some members of the business community, higher education together, and focus on what is the purpose of K-12 education, pre-K-12 education in Wisconsin today. If you ask any of them that, they will be on very different pages, which I also think drives a lot of the division that we see and why they can't come together around a common agenda. I don't see a common reason or a reason why they think that schools should even exist. What is the role they play? I think if we were able to iron something like that out, it would at least give us a common target to aim for that we could rally people around to really help our students.
All right. That will be the final word. Thank you to all three of you for a wonderful conversation.
Thank you.
And thank you to our viewers. Be sure to tune in again as we highlight the issues and sit down with the decision makers who make a difference for all of us.
This program is a production of Wisconsin Eye, an independent, nonpartisan, nonprofit media network with a mission to inform, educate, and engage the citizens of Wisconsin. Wisconsin Eye is the nation's first and only independently funded state civics broadcast network, providing gavel-to-gavel access to government proceedings and events at the state capitol.